Today is March 13, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I'm interviewing George Woods over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. George, can you begin with when and where you were born?
Yes, well, I was in born in a little town called Portageville, Missouri, in 1943, and that's February 11th. At the age of two, my mother and I moved to Sykeston, Missouri, and that's where I grew up and graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your family and what it was like growing up.
Well, Sykeston was a good place to grow up, I always thought. At the time, I didn't think about things like that, but now looking back on it, it was a great place, nice little quiet town. And we were basically a football town, and the biggest ambition a young kid growing up would be to grow up and be a Bulldog, which was our football town, team's name. But as I grew up, and I loved sports, I loved everything, sandlot, baseball, softball, football, basketball, you name it, and I did it. I think there was weren't very many trees in Sykeston that I didn't end up climbing. So, it's just a very active youth. And then when I went to high school, I was finally introduced to organized sports, and I did excel and make the football team and so forth in football. But track and field, I always had a very interest, a talent, I guess you could say, in track and field and throwing. Now, I have a story in the football team, my senior year, well, junior and senior year, there was a tackle that I admired quite a bit. He had every high school weightlifting record, and he was an all-conference football player, tackle on the football team, and on. I admired him very much, named Joe Humes. And I started throwing the shot put my freshman year in high school. And by my sophomore year, I had exceeded his shot and discus records. And I had broken about three of his weightlifting records. And by the time I graduated, I had broken all of his weightlifting records. And then I went on, and my senior year was the first Missouri high school shot putter to throw the 12-pound shot over 60 feet and won the state championship. So I really enjoyed track and field more than football in that I played fullback on the football team, and some of my touchdowns were called back because somebody on my team would clip somebody and this, that, and the other, being a team sport. Whereas track and field, when I went out there and competed in track and field and shot putting, for example, it was me against whoever else was the rest of the competition. So if I didn't win, it was my fault and not somebody else's fault. And that's the part I really enjoyed. I loved to compete head-to-head with the rest of the shot putters and discus. So I threw the discus, and I jumped, and I did a lot of stuff back in those days. And so basically that was my background in a nutshell.
Yeah, that was a wonderful summary. So what was it like to, somebody that you looked up to, what was it like to best their accomplishments?
Well, at that time, that was probably the biggest thrill of my life because, like I say, I respected Joe Humes very much. He was strongest guy in school and all conference and just, someone to look up to. And to think that all of a sudden, my sophomore year, I exceeded his discus record, more accidental than anything else, I think, at that time. But by my junior year, I broke his shot put and his discus record again and ended up furthering all of those, and I ended up breaking all of his weightlifting records. So I was It was a very satisfying thing to do. Let's put it that way.
So were most of your friends also athletes?
Yeah, pretty much. Now, one thing, too, I might note here, a little bit of history, actually, but at that time when I was in high school, the prevailing thought by coaches was that weightlifting made you muscle bound, and so they would try to limit the athletes from weightlifting. And I basically was one of the first athletes to enjoy weightlifting. I started my sophomore year, and I went during the winter. I didn't play basketball for the high school. I played church league, but I didn't play high school. So I started weightlifting. Then when I'd come into the track season, I was, you know, pretty strong, and so I'd throw a shot so far. But then all of a sudden, I during as the season would go along, the track season, my throws would start, they wouldn't diminish, but they wouldn't keep improving. And all of a sudden, I got to thinking about that. And so it was because the coach had made me stop weightlifting. So basically, I found out, you know, did a little research and so forth, and found out that the weightlift, you know, the shot putters, the big guys, Dallas Long and oh, heck, Perry O'Brien and guys like that, were lifting year-round. And they weren't muscle bound. So I got my own set of weights about my freshman year in high school and started lifting. And I lifted through the football season as well as the track season and all basically year round. And I really started blossoming as a shot putter by my senior year. And I contribute that a lot to my success, weightlifting program year round. Even though I was going against the coaches. Nowadays, the coaches have finally decided and learned that they've got to hit the weights. Otherwise, they will taper off during the season because the strength level starts to diminish.
Thank you for sharing that. That's actually really valuable information. Some people might be really interested to know what lifts you were doing.
Well, basically, it was powerlifting, and I would do this. The bench press was primary, and squats and power cleans, and then some setups and some wrist work, and that stayed with me throughout my entire career. Those were my five basic lifts, and I tried constantly to get as strong as I could in all five of those.
So, how intensive was your training at, you know, leading up to the 68 trials?
Well, I guess, of course, by 68, I'd gone through college, and I was living out in Los Angeles at the time, and I was lifting quite a bit more than I could in high school, and so I was continuously lifting throughout the years. And then throwing, I guess, basically, when I looked at a lot of other shot putters who I've competed against over the years, I think, and I'm not saying 100%, but there might have been a few more, but I think I probably threw the shot, actually, in practice, more than most shot putters. I threw maybe close to 75 to 100 throws, and that's not all coming across the circle with technique. I guess I'd throw maybe 25 to 30 with technique, and then the rest of it would be maybe with a heavier shot put or something like that, just throwing from the front of the circle, just developing finger strength and so forth. But I think I had a pretty strong work ethic at that point.
Did you ever feel like your work ethic in shot put ever interfered with other areas of your life?
Not at that time. Not at that time. Later in my life, when I 68, and then I was going, just a little complicated. But at that time, I had retired after 68, thinking I was going to play professional football for the Cardinals. So my wife and I moved all the way back to the St. Louis area, and I tried out. Well, I didn't actually try out. I went to a camp. And at that time, they wanted a guy to replace a guard that was about to retire, and so they were wanting me to be that guy because I was 6'2", and they wanted the defensive guys to be 6'4" and 6'5", so the quarterbacks couldn't see over them. And yet I was the strongest guy. I would have been the strongest guy on the team, and there were some very, very good defensive players at the time that were 6'2". So I think I could have played it, but they weren't wanted me to play guard. I'd never played guard. I'd played fullback and defensive linebacker in high school. And so I'd had to learn the position and so forth. So I told them to forget it. And I came back and was reinstated into I got my amateur standing back because I had received no money at that time for my experience in the football thing. But at that time, then I had to start getting a job, getting out to the real world to support my wife and myself. And at that time, I think my sports training was a little more difficult because I had to spend 8 hours a day at a job and then go out after that and train. And so it was pretty hard on me. Now, when I was in Los Angeles, I had to do the same. As a matter of fact, let me tell you a story. Leading up to the 68 Olympics, I was living, my wife and I were living in Los Angeles at the time, and due to the daylight savings and all, I would spend my entire day, 8 hours, working at a job, is a desk job, and then I would go out, and it would be dark by the time I could get dressed, go out and practice. I'd go to a local high school and practice. And they didn't have any lights out. They had a street light at the end of the football field, and the shot put was normally at the end of a football field. And so I couldn't find my shot half the time because it was dark and the grass was dark and everything else. So I ended up painting my shot put white so that I could find it after throwing it. So a lot of my practice for the 2 years we lived in Los Angeles was with a painted shot put. Good old days.
Yeah. At Southern Illinois, did you have a scholarship?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that helped a lot with giving you time to train and whatnot, but then you just described afterwards having to work 8 hours a day and find your shot put in the dark. Leading up to the trials and then making the Olympic trials, during that whole process, were there any challenges or problems? Can you describe what the process was like and where the trials were held?
Well, okay, let's back up one little trip to the year before in 67. It had always been my ambition to make an Olympic team. And, of course, in the shot put, at that time, there was two men that were really good. Randy Matson had been the first human ever to throw over 70 feet. His world record was 71, something like 5.5 or 6.5, something like that. And then there was Neil Steinhauer from Oregon, and he had thrown high 67, 67-10, I think. And so... And then there was a group of guys, and there's only three places in the Olympics, you know, on the Olympic team. And so I was mentally wondering who the competition would be for that third spot. And I had about, myself included, about four, maybe five shot putters that stood a chance. We were all going to be fighting out for that third spot. Well, I'd weightlifted real hard and, done everything right, and between indoor season and outdoor season, I'd taken about a month off and really hit the weights hard and competed outdoors. And then to qualify for the Olympic trials that year, you had to either qualify in the top six in the AAU championships or the top, I think it was two, in the all armed forces meet, or in the NCAA, that may be a little top four or five. I can't remember the exact numbers, but you had to qualify for the Olympic trials through one of those three track meets. And I, of course, qualified through the AAU championships. I went all summer long throwing. They had seemed like there was about eight of us or so who qualified through those. And then we went to the final Olympic trials. Now, prior to the Olympic trials, I had once again taken another month off, hit the weights real hard, came back in about the middle of the summer, and stronger than I'd ever been, and a lot of snap and everything. And all of a sudden, we had an Olympic development meet down in Texas, and Randy was there. And it was the first time I'd ever beat him. I beat him, and I couldn't believe it. And I think I threw 67 plus something. I can't remember the inches and everything. Then I think I beat him another game, another one. So I had beaten him twice going into the trials. And then in South Lake Tahoe, we had, face-to-face again and all. And Neil Steinhardt at that time, one of the guys that I had predicted would be, a shoe-in, had hurt his ankle, I think it was, and he was really unable to throw very far, so he didn't make it. And Randy, I beat Randy in the trials, set a new trials record, 68-2, I think. And then, of course, Dave Maggard won at around 65 and a half feet. I'm guessing at some of these distances. That's when some of them are fuzzy now. But amazing thing is, I think the whole point of this is to say that a year before that, I was hoping to make the Olympic team. Then all of a sudden, here a year later, I'm the Olympic trials record holder. I've beaten the biggest, the man himself, 70, Randy Matson, three times in a row. And all of a sudden, my aspirations came from not making the team or trying to make the team in third spot to all of a sudden, hey, I've got a real shot at this. So it's funny how your things change, as the season goes along, and all of a sudden things break for you, and all of a sudden you actually stand a chance of winning. And I'll say this: I would have been pleased a year before that to just have made the team. And then when I finally went to the Olympics and got second place, it was actually a disappointment. does that sound? It was actually a disappointment that I didn't win the darn thing.
Well, that's not surprising to hear, because a lot of the athletes that I've talked to feel the same way, but it is sort of ironic.
It was going to be a tussle. Well, let me also at this time, I guess I'd better interject. Something happened to me up in South Lake Tahoe prior to the trials that probably it bothered me the rest of my career. I was weightlifting in the weightlifting room, and at that time I told you one of my exercises was a power jerk and power cleans, but the power jerk I was that's where you take the weight off of the, a power rack and thrust it over your head, like in a press movement, only you throw it real hard and bend at the knees and so forth. And I was doing some pretty heavy weight at that time, and it got just slightly off forward of my center gravity there. And I tried to say it started coming down, and I tried to save it, and so I stepped forward, and the bar bent my wrist back and actually broke a bone in my right wrist. And, one of the little small bones in the wrist that slide back and forth. And so from then on in my entire career, I had the problems. I always had to tape that wrist. And going into the Olympics, I was practicing with tape on my hand, on my wrist. And all of a sudden, I was told the day before the games themselves, qualifying and so forth, I couldn't tape my wrist. Well, okay. That was a problem, but because I hadn't been practicing without tape, tape was preventing my wrist from going back and that little broken bone from sliding into kind of a little space there and hurting. So then I got into the games themselves and warming up, and I saw this European, I don't forget what country he was from, he had tape on his wrist. And so I asked the officials about that. They said, well, yeah, you can tape your wrist if you have a medical permission, you know, from a teen doctor or something to do so, proving that you have an injury. Well, that really didn't sit right with me, because I thought, frankly, that my team, the coaches and the people that were assigned to help us, none of them knew anything about that. Now, I'm sitting here thinking, for crying out loud, here is the biggest competition in the world. We're from the best country in the world, and nobody knew that I could use tape if I had a doctor's permission. And I had a doctor's permission all along to do that. But, you know, no one knew it. No one told me. And so, therefore, I had to compete in the games without tape. What happened by the time I had warmed up in the actual competition, I threw my very first throw, which really, you know, hurt the wrist quite a bit. And that was the throw right there, the first throw that won me the silver medal. I had in practice been exceeding 69 feet in practice, and Randy won the gold medal at, it's about 67.4, something like that, that day. And that's another thing that aggravates me, because I think I could have beat him if I'd had a healthy wrist. But anyway, that's water under the bridge. The point being, the next two throws in the prelims, I threw the first throw. I passed on the second throw. I threw the third throw, which amounted to nothing because it was hurting so bad. I made the finals with that first throw, and then I decided I'm going to skip the next two throws, and then I'd have that last throw to try to come back and win it, hoping that the wrist would start feeling a little better and so forth, and stop throbbing and the whole business before that last throw. And I threw, and it was a decent throw, but it wasn't the throw I needed. And so it was the first throw. And then years and years after that, I was always having to tape that wrist. Right now I can look at that wrist, and there's a big bump there where that broken bone has finally attached itself to another bone. But the way that whole thing went down was a disappointment to me.
Absolutely. How frustrating.
Yeah, it's frustrating. But when I look at some of the others, like Neil Steinhauer now, for example, Neil was a very, very good shot putter, and he could have made the Olympic team, but he hurt his ankle before the game. I can't remember, but he had been messing around with it for something like a month before the trials. And so he went through disappointment. So I tell you, those injuries can really take a toll.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. So how did your friends and employer and family, how did they react to finding out that you were going to the Olympic Games?
Well, my family was happy. I called my wife that night from Tahoe and told her that I'd made the team, and I was tickled pink, and called my mom. She's, you know, told her, and she was happy. The job, I worked for the Insurance Company of North America at the time as an underwriter. And I told them that I'd made the team, and I was going to have to go spend time, in the training sites prior to, and then we would fly the team down to Mexico City. They weren't going to give me time off, so I had to quit my job. I kind of thought that was funny, too, because at the time, a lot of the companies were giving the athletes who had jobs with them time off to go to the Olympics. You know, it was a good advertisement for them. Mm-hmm. But the insurance company in North America didn't see it that way, so I quit my job with them. And but that was the only, you know, other than that, everybody was happy for me.
Mm-hmm. Gosh. So after you won the silver medal and you came back home, did anybody from that company ever contact you?
Nope. Not a thing. Not a word.
Oh, how strange.
Yeah.
Was your wife able to go to Mexico City with you?
No, and I tell you, it's an unfortunate thing, too, because I went to three Olympic Games, and people don't understand when I say, no, she didn't get to go, because at that time, first of all, If you had your wife, if she couldn't live in the village with you, we'd have to get housing outside the village. And some of those places that were going, like, you'd have to have reservations in individual housing or what have you, 2 years in advance. Otherwise, they're gone because of the demand, for the Olympic Games and so forth. And you never really and truly knew whether or not you were going to make the team. And so, here spending all that money for a space to hold for her 2 years in advance, and I didn't know if I was going to make the team or not even. So she never really got to go on. And then all of a sudden, what happened in 72, Munich, the Black September organization that killed all the Israeli teams and the terrorism and stuff like that, made it, well, actually, I was happy that she wasn't with me because that's just too doggone dangerous. I didn't want her involved in anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, she never really got to go to any of the Olympic team. No, she did get to go to Europe with me in 73 she got to go.
Mm.
We toured Europe a little bit with my track team, but other than that, she never really got to go with me.
I see. Well, what about the altitude of Mexico City? Were you at all worried about that? Did that affect your training or preparation at all?
No, not at all, because you see, the high altitude affects endurance events, runners, milers, people had to run far and so forth, that needed a lot of oxygen. But shot putting doesn't. Shot put may last once you get started across the ring. It's probably over in a second, And so you never really get winded from it. It's not a aerobic type of exercise. It's just anaerobic, what you've got stored in your muscles, and then your training, technique and strength. And so as far as that, and that probably would hold true with most of the field events. And I'm separating track events from field events. Track is your running, and you need oxygen for that. Field is your jumping, throwing, and so forth. And that's why, look at the record. Bemis jumped 29.2. I'm not sure. I haven't been up on this, but I'm not sure. But that record still may hold as a world record in the broad jump. And I'm going to get his name in a minute, the Fosbury and the high jump. And, I know, there's just tremendous performances in field events because of the altitude. As a matter of fact, it probably helped the field events, throwing, jumping, but it did not help the running. That's where, so runners will have a much, much harder time in high altitude.
Mm-hmm. So you feel that it helped you, the thin air? Do you think it helped you at all, or you were not helped by it? Do you think anyone?
Well, I can't say it actually helped, because like I said, I had that sore wrist and everything, but it didn't hinder me. I don't think it hindered me at all.
Right. Who were some of your closest friends on the U.S. team?
Well, there again, I guess competition, I've never really been able to be, excuse me, real close to guys that I'm trying to win from.
Mm-hmm.
So Randy and I and Dave Maggard and I weren't that friendly. Not that we were bitter enemies and so forth, but we just didn't hang together. I always liked, there was a discusaur, L.J. Sylvester, and he and I were close friends, and we hung together during the Olympic Games and so forth, and did things. As a matter of fact, he and I were friends through all three of my Olympic Games. But I, and then I knew some of the runners and some of the guys on the same team. I represented the Pacific Coast Club at the time. I threw for them during the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know quite a few of them. But as far as my competition, I think probably ended up, Randy and I probably ended up better friends as the years went by, rather than in Mexico. I can remember when I was, I guess that was about 1963, when Randy first came onto the scene as a high schooler. And he and I, after the track meets, we'd sit there and talk over technique and things like that. But by the time the 68 games came around and I was, you know, throwing far enough to actually be a concern to him, he kind of was cool to me. He treated me kind of cool. And so, you know, I shrugged and went on.
Yeah. What about today? Do you talk to any of the 68 team members, aside from Tom Lowe? Are you friendly with them today?
I have been in the past. Recently, I haven't. Tom is the only one that calls. They used to have a thing, and I can't remember. It was a weight throwers coaches clinic, and they used to have that every year, and I used to be invited to that, and all of a sudden they stopped inviting me. But at that time, they would invite some of the guys. I got to see Jay Sylvester there again, and of course Brian Oldfield and so forth. But for the most part, no, I don't call them up and so forth. They don't call. So just memories. It was a delight to me, frankly, to go to New Orleans I can't even remember the year, but they had a reunion for us. Was that 98 maybe? 98, 40-year reunion?
Yeah.
I can't remember. They had a reunion, though, of the team, and I didn't realize it at the time. But they say, anyway, that was the best track and field team ever from the United States ever assembled. Mm-hmm. I mean, we won more medals, more world records, all kinds of stuff like that, which was impressive. But I enjoyed going down to New Orleans and meeting all the guys again. Hal Connolly and the Hammer, and of course, Jay Sylvester, Discosaur. Al Lorder made one of them. I got pretty friendly with Al, too. I knew him quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Discosaur. Mm-hmm.
So, rewinding back 47 years ago, while you were preparing to go down to Mexico and you were in the training camp, do you remember hearing anything about, issues or unhappiness among some of the track and field athletes and possible protests or boycotts by some of the track and field athletes, particularly the African-American track and field athletes?
Well, I didn't really, maybe I just wasn't paying attention. I'm sure if I would have been, I was, you know, I kind of liked Willie Davenport and I kind of liked Ralph Boston. They were, you know, friendly guys and all. I don't ever remember being up or privy to any of the plans that they were doing, and I guess you're asking me about the demonstration by Smith and Carlos up on the stand.
Well, I'm asking. I'll definitely ask about that, but also there were like some letters circulating, and kind of like a movement that was circulating called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, and it was co-founded by. It involved Dr. Martin Luther King, and since he had been assassinated that year in April, I was just wondering, if that had any effect on the team while they were preparing to go down to Mexico.
I would say no. First of all, I'll just have to give you my opinion on all of it. I've always felt that the Olympic Games, we should always keep the Olympic Games in the same ideal as the original games back in Greece. You know, they would actually stop battles. If two countries were fighting, an Olympic procession would come through. They would actually stop the fighting and stand aside and let the Olympic procession go through peacefully. I have always thought that Olympic Games should be above political strife and statements and so forth. Now, I can see why it's so popular, an agenda, a place to say something, make a statement or whatever, because the whole world is watching. But I have always liked to think that the Olympic Games should be a place where countries, regardless of ideology and so forth of the governments, should get together under peaceful terms and compete honestly one-to-one with all the other country or, you know, athletes from in your event, and, you know, develop. First of all, I think it's an excellent thing to develop peace among countries, that relationship that athletes have from other countries. But at the time, I was ignorant of the fact that there was any kind of a movement afoot on that. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, the thing that happened in the games was kind of a surprise to me, and I didn't necessarily think that it was the correct thing, mm-hmm. you know, to do.
Mm-hmm. So going back to that Tlatelolco massacre question,
yes.
If you could just say what you knew about it and what you had heard about 10 days before the start of the games in Mexico City, possibly as many as 300 people were killed. So if you could just say what you remember hearing at the time.
Well, we had been told, you know, at that time we were a team. We had gone into Denver for fitting and so forth of our uniforms, and we were practicing as a team and so forth. And we were told that there had been some demonstrations in Mexico, that the Mexican government had stated that they had everything under control, and that we're not to be worried. But we had been warned that to be on the alert, so to speak. Don't try to go anywhere by yourself and so forth when we got into Mexico City. And then on the way down, we had heard that there had been some people shot and killed, but that everything was quiet and the Mexican government had everything under control. And that's, frankly, that's the extent of it. I had never realized that 300 is an enormous amount of death. That's such a shame.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but like I say, I didn't know any more than that.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Mexico City and its people when you first arrived for the games?
Well, I saw nothing but people who were just absolutely in love with Olympic athletes. I know we could get out, that we could go from the stadium to our village and so forth, back and forth, and they give these little trade pins. They give you so many trade pins, and the athletes trade among themselves. Like if you wanted a trade pin from Russia, you trade a Russian for his trade pin, you give him yours. And there was a lot of that, and there was a lot of these young Mexican children running around, and they were getting those trade pins somehow. And boy, they would run up, and if I was from the United States, if they didn't have one, they'd want one of mine, and so forth, and tickle me. One of the little trade pins, I didn't really, you know, I wasn't into that. I was trading, and I ended up with quite a collection. But this one little guy, he wanted a U.S. Trade pin so bad, so I traded him one, and he gave me one. And then when I got back to the room, I started looking to see what I had, and it was a homemade trade pin. He'd stuck a pin on the back of a little, like almost a button with something on it. And but you know, they loved this, really. It seemed to me, and I didn't feel any danger or anything. They were just great people, nice people.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to venture out into the city and go sightseeing?
Occasionally, once in a while, we as a group would get together. I'm trying to think of how that came about, but a couple of us went out with a couple of Mexican guys. Well, not just guy. It was let's see. There was about two girls and a guy, and they were gonna show us around and everything, and we went driving around with them. Let's see. And once in a while we'd go out, but not very far. We wouldn't just, go out far because our main intent right then was training and competition. So, but yeah, I got to see a little bit. I got to see some of the University of Mexico down there and some of the old statues and artwork and so forth on that campus. That's a beautiful campus, by the way.
I'd love to see it someday.
Oh, you've got to put that on your bucket list.
Definitely. So, what did you think of the event venues, the stadium or arena where you competed?
I thought everything for the main menus were great. The only thing I really ran into trouble was, and I guess they didn't realize this, but the shot putters and discus throwers are weightlifters. weightlifters. They have to weightlift to get stronger and keep the strength level up so that they can throw those silly things, shot put, discus, and so forth, and the hammer and javelin and so forth. And they had fine facilities for the weightlifters themselves, from the various teams. But we, the throwers, didn't have the permission to go into these gymnasiums where all those weights are for the weightlifters. So when we started hollering, we needed weights and so forth, they threw up a little tent outside and had some of these, they weren't Olympic bars at all. They were just these little bars that, and I don't know how much weight there, but certainly not the type of setup that we were used to. I make kind of a joke because one time I went to this tent to get a workout, and the Russian women shot putters were doing their routine. And so when they got done, I unloaded the bar and got my workout. I make that joke because, they were lifting pretty heavy weights too, the female shot putters from Russia. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have nearly enough facilities, not enough weights. So the weightlifting portion of it, the training portion of it for the throwers was very inadequate, unfortunately. But other than that, the facilities were great.
Let me ask you, were the female shot putters from the U.S. Lifting any weights?
Yeah, but the thing is, you see, they could get by with what they had because chances are, like, for example, if I'm bench pressing, say, 500 pounds to throw the shot, 16-pound shot, they only have to maybe be lifting 250 or I don't know what the women lift, especially nowadays. But at that time, that's a pretty good workout for them probably. But they're throwing the 8-pound shot. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So they don't have to be nearly as strong as the men who throw the 16-pound shot. And so, therefore, when you go up in real heavy weights, there's just not enough weight in that little tent. And the bench was rickety and everything. It was just a haphazard thing. They just threw it up there to appease our complaints. And it was totally inadequate. Basically, what happened is we had to change our training situation. Instead of lifting heavy weights for lower reps, we had to lift lighter weights for higher reps. And that's a whole different training technique.
Mm-hmm.
But we got through it.
So since you were in multiple Olympic Games, what were your impressions of security measures in Mexico City compared to some of the other games that you've been to?
Well, I'll tell you, in 68, now, once again, I was totally oblivious to the fact that we'd had the Mexican government had problems down there and had shootings, and I just assumed when I heard that the government had everything under control and the people loved us and so forth, and I did not feel any at any point there where I was in danger or threatened in any way. Now, let's go 4 years, you know, later, mm-hmm. Munich, that was a whole different ball game. I didn't feel anything up until the time that the Black September organization took over the Israeli dorms, killed the I think three guys got shot right off the bat. They were trying to escape, and the terrorists shot them. Now, if you know anything about the village in Munich, and this is more Munich than Mexico, I don't know how much of this you want to hear, but the dormitories were arranged in long parallel rows, various countries staying in one dorm, a set of dorms, and then another one. And we were in the dormitory right across from the Israeli dorms. And I was sleeping that night when the terrorists took over the Israeli compound there, and I heard the shots that killed the guys trying to escape, and I just assumed, it kind of woke me up a little bit, I just assumed somebody won a gold medal and was throwing firecrackers out the window. Mm. And so I went on back to sleep. Next morning when I woke up, that whole area was cordoned off, military types with automatic weapons were walking around the perimeter. We had to, instead of just going right down the walkway to the, they were arranged in kind of like a T, and we walked down to the end, and there was all the stores and the cafeterias were. And instead of doing that, we had to take a big roundabout to get to the cafeterias, to the food. There was some talk about canceling the rest of the games. And I hadn't even thrown yet, you know, so that upset me. And so it was a mess. But, you know, the Olympic Committee at that time decided that they were going to go ahead and hold the rest of the games. Otherwise, the Black September group would have won, you know, what they wanted to do is upset the games. Mm-hmm. Now, carry that another 4 years. And in Montreal, they had the entire village surrounded by a chicken link fence. Outside, they had guards with guard dogs walking all around the outside perimeter all day and night. As a matter of fact, kind of they did so much walking around the outside that they actually had walked a trench around the entire village, you know, keeping track of everything and the dogs and everything. And I bet that trench was at least 6 inches deep where they walked constantly. Mm. But you're very much aware. In Montreal, very much aware. We had a practice field that we would go and practice on, and that wasn't part of the immediate area there. So we had to get on a bus and go through part of the town to get there. And they had guards front and back of the bus, all the way there, watching us, bringing us all the way back. It was like almost being in a, you know, like a prison camp or something. It was really wild. And that really brings it back home to you. And I'm hoping some of these Olympics we see now, China was wonderful. Boy, China, you look at China, they put on a show. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that has kind of, but on the other hand, now all of a sudden we get this thing over in Russia this year for the Winter Games, and I understand that the security was very, very, very tight there. And so that kind of stuff kind of weighs on your mind. You don't have the freedom to really and truly enjoy yourself, I don't think.
Yeah. Describe your accommodations in the Olympic Village. What were they like?
In 68, they weren't bad. They were, it was like how to describe it? It was like a set of, maybe like dormitories. And what they were going to do, I understand, is after the games, they were going to convert those into family housing. But you'd go into a room and maybe, like the United States might have about two or three of those together, and each of the areas might have about three bedrooms. Let's see, there's one, two, three. There was three bedrooms and a smaller bedroom, and the one in Munich. Let's see, I'm trying to okay, and there's like about three bedrooms in the in Mexico City, and of course maybe two athletes per bedroom, and then of course each one self-contained, had the bathroom and a living area. And then, like I say, I understand that when the games were over, they were going to convert those into housing for people. And so, therefore, they were pretty nice. You know, they weren't really extravagant, but they were certainly nice enough.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who any of your roommates or suite mates were?
68. Oh, man. I have a picture or two in my mind, but I can't remember. It was a runner named Day. He was in there with us. I didn't have any of the weight people in there, though. I can't remember.
Okay. Now, no worries.
72 and 76, I can. Jay and I, Jay Sylvester and I, roomed in one bedroom, and Jay and Bruce Jenner and another decathlon roomed in the other. So basically, I tell everybody I roomed with Bruce Jenner, but I didn't really room with him. We were in the same apartment,
uh-huh.
But we were in a different bedroom from uh-huh. each other, but opening out. But no, I can't remember, honestly. It was a couple of runners. And I'm thinking there was a decathlon guy. And after the competition, I ended up with one of the shot puts from the competition, and I didn't want to worry about bringing it back home because I had shot puts at home, and he was a decathlon, and those guys are always fighting for you know, equipment, and so I just gave him my shot put, and I'd forgotten all about it, and oh, I don't know, 6 years later, he came up to me at a track meet, and I didn't even remember him, and I says, you remember you gave me that shot put and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, he was in there too at decathlon. I couldn't give you his name. It wasn't Toomey who won the decathlon that year.
Mm-hmm.
So wasn't anybody's, you know, super.
Okay. did you or anyone you know suffer any intestinal illnesses from the water while you were there?
Everybody. Oh. Everybody. Well, I'm going to tell you, maybe getting kind of gross.
That's okay.
Myself, for example, I was lucky. I would start to get a little touch of dysentery, and they had some little white pills they'd give you, the training room. I'd take a couple of those, and I'd be all right for about 2 days. Then all of a sudden, here it'd come back on me. So these little white pills put me all the way through the games without really getting sick.
Mm.
But I know, for example, hammer thrower Burke, he got so sick that when they after his event, they flew him back to Los Angeles and put him in the hospital. Frank Batchelor, who was, I think he was a runner. I think he was competing in the half mile, 800 meters it would have been. Anyway, it was a longer race. And he was so sick that, how can I say this delicately? He was competing. And he couldn't hold on. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay. Well, and he couldn't hold back, and it started running down his legs and everything, and that would be so embarrassing. But yeah, that was rampant. And the thing is, supposedly they had clean water in the rooms for us to, you know, bottled water, so we drank that. But the problem was, they would get food and they would rinse the food, you know, the vegetables and so forth, in their water. And so therefore, bang, you eat any vegetable and you got sick.
Mm.
So yeah, there was a lot of that. That was probably one of the biggest health problems that we had.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other health problems?
Well, I don't know. I really didn't run into anything but that. I'm trying to think of if I knew anybody else that got sick or anything in any other way. So I think that was the problem. Let's put it that way.
Okay. What are your most vivid memories of the Olympic opening ceremony?
Okay, here's another thing. If you competed the next day, they would let you out of the Olympic opening day ceremonies, because opening day you had to stand on your feet. You had to march into the stadium, stand there for, oh, I don't know, 2-3 hours, and they felt that that would hurt your performance the next day, and shot put was one of those that started early, so I didn't even attend the opening days.
I see.
Now, in Munich, yes, I did, and that was Munich. That's a different story. I got a story to tell there, but I won't bother. This is 68 we're talking about. But,
well, I'm open to all good stories, so if you have a story.
Well, we would march into the stadium in 1972, and it was about a 2 or 3 mile walk, a march, and we were a United States team. Boy, we were gaily dressed in bright red blazers, snow white pants, navy blue shirt, red, white, blue striped tie, hat. Our jackets had ornate buttons on it and everything. And I, unfortunately, was right on the end of you know, here we are in rows, parallel rows, and we're marching. And the people along the sides of the road wanted souvenirs so badly that they would literally reach out and snap the buttons off your jacket. And when I got to the stadium, I didn't have, there was a, on the cuff, you know, you had those buttons.
Uh-huh.
I had 4 buttons on either side. And when I finally got to the stadium, on that one side facing the people, I didn't have one single button left.
Oh, my goodness.
I just reach out and grab those buttons and pull them off.
Oh, wow. I've never heard anything like that before.
Yeah. I'll tell you something else, too, and I'm sure you've heard this, but and it's probably a problem in 68, I don't know, but we all marched to the stadium and stood out there on the infield, and all of a sudden they released, I think it was like 30,000 pigeons overhead. Well, pigeons can't just fly up and out of a stadium. They don't have the power, so they had to circle and keep circling. And every time they circle, they get a little higher and a little higher. And finally, they got so high that they flew out of the stadium. But in the meantime, they'd been in those pens, I guess, for a long time. And they started pooping on everybody.
Oh.
And I can remember, here we're in our beautiful uniform, beautiful colors and everything. And all of a sudden, we're getting bombed. You know? So, I don't know. It was... Yeah, that was an experience. I know the girls were all running around. We had the programs of the games and so forth. So they'd put those programs over their head to protect their hair. And oh, that was a mess. Those are the two big things that I remember about the opening day ceremony.
Yeah, those are both great stories.
But that was 72.
Yeah. So 1968 was a big time for the Cold War. What effect, if any, did this political climate have on the games and any interactions that you might have had with Soviet bloc athletes?
Well, I always found, and I tried to talk to Russian shot putters, so we knew them. Matter of fact, the Russian shot putter got the bronze medal in the Olympic Games in 68. He seemed like a friendly guy, but, you know, you try to sit down and talk to them. And, you know, when shot putters get together, one of the big topics is, how do you train? What do you do in training? We're all interested in what everybody, you know, other athletes are training. And, you know, they'd ask us how we train. We'd tell them, no problem. I mean, it's no big secret. And then we'd ask, how do you train? And they'd look at it and shake their heads. Much the same way. And in other words, I think I think their handlers, if you want to call them that, or their coaches had told them, don't divulge any secrets. You know, don't tell them how we train. But the thing is, at that time anyway, we were so superior to them that whatever they trained like wouldn't have been, you know, helpful to us because we were the best in the world. But you got a lot of that. I-72 got a lot of that, especially from the East Germans. The East Germans were very closed mouth, and the Russians, they won't divulge anything to you about the training techniques. Mm-hmm. At least up to that point, they did.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you were trying to find out more information, but were kind of stonewalled. What did you know about how the Soviets trained?
Well, only from what we had heard. We had heard that in 68, the steroid craze had not hit and so forth. We had heard that they were training on steroids. Now this is later, like 72, I had heard that they had come up, you know, do you know what a muscle stim machine is?
Yes.
Yeah. In the training room, they'll, if you've got an injury or whatever, they'll put those pads on you and then turn the power on. It'll make your muscles tense and jerk and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We had heard that they had gotten away from weightlifting, and they had went to those machines, and they turn them up so high, and it would contract the muscles so strongly that it was the same effect as weightlifting. But they didn't have to weightlift. You know, they didn't have to lift the weight and get injured and whatever. They just sit there and put the juice, say, to your bicep, and your arm would bend and so forth. And that's how they were training. And then we heard rumors that they were training on the growth hormone and so forth. But they, I don't know how much of that was frankly just hype, you know, or stuff to mislead us or whatever, and how much of it was true.
Mm.
But I do know for rehabilitation of people who have severe injuries, some of their muscles don't work properly, they put those tens unit on those things, you know, those muscle stims, and they're able to go through range of motion that normally they've lost the capacity to do, and it helps rehabilitate them. And I'm speaking of anybody, not just Russians or whatever. But whether or not you can train on them, I don't know.
Mm.
But in other words, what we heard that they were doing was just strictly hearsay because none of them would tell us anything. Top secret.
Yeah. So 1968 were the first Olympic Games, Summer Olympic Games, at which standardized drug testing was implemented. What was your experience with the drug testing program in 1968?
Let me think. 68. I don't remember any anything out. You know, not normal. We just went under the stadium there, and they had a place to give a urine sample. And beyond that, that was it. And of course, everybody at that time passed. Nobody was using steroids or anything. So I don't remember anything abnormal about it. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Does anything about the drug testing from 72 or Montreal stick out in your mind?
Well, yeah, they were starting to crack down on the steroids, and they were starting to test. And once again, here's the rumor, but we had heard that the Russians had been training on steroids, but they had doctors that had, knew how to mask steroid use in the tests that were used at that time. And so, you know, but of course, you know, Americans at that time, we were behind the times and we hadn't been using steroids like that. So, once again, I'm trying to think of anybody in 68 or 72 that had even been caught. Now, in subsequent, not even 76 and trade, but some of the sprinters and so forth have been recently, you know, like within the intervening years now in the 80s and 90s were caught with steroid use.
Mm-hmm.
But, and of course, I guess some of that stuff is ridiculous. I tell you one story I can remember when we went to Montreal, checked into our rooms, and they gave us a little, what do you want to call it, a welcome pack, a little bag with all kinds of little goodies in it, and they had a little bottle of Visine in case of, you know, our eyes got dry or whatever. The first thing our trainers did was run around to all the rooms confiscating those things because evidently Visine had an element in it, a chemical in it, that was on the ban list. And if we used it, it could show up in our blood after the competition, and we could get banned from that. And I'm sitting there thinking, for crying out loud, you can't possibly put enough eye drops in your eyes to enhance your performance. And yet that's how severe, how bad they were. I mean, just they wouldn't test and try to find out how much of this stuff was in your bloodstream, enough to make you, you know, perform better. They would just test for positive or negative. And if you were positive, bingo, you were out, gone. Mm. So we had to turn in all of our Visine. That was in Montreal. So things were starting to get tighter and tighter at that time.
I see. What about the gender verification testing that was introduced in 1968? Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, I remember that Tamara Press, she was the biggest joke. She was a shot putter from Russia and had won just about every Olympic in the shot put event up until then. And they came in with the visual exam for the women. And she quit. She wasn't going to go. There was some suspicion all along that she might have been a man that was, I don't know, worked over
by the
doctors or whatever. But anyway, yeah, that there was a lot of that cheating going on at that time. I'll tell you one thing, though, and I can't remember her name, but I remember a story. I think she was Finland, but I'm not sure about that. She's one of those countries. And she was a very good runner, and she'd won the Olympic Games, okay? They tested her blood and found a triple. She had triple X chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You know, the triple X, you know, women are supposed to have 2X, men supposed to have the XY.
Right.
And the men determine the sex of the child. Okay, she had 3Xs. And so they disqualified her and took her medal away. She at home had a husband and some children. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if a woman can have a child, person can have a child, she's a woman. And so why would they strip her medal from her because she had 3X chromosomes? But supposedly that made her a super person. But, hey, you know, so basically are we saying that the Olympic Games should only be for normal people? You know, what if you're super? Are you just out? You just have to buy a cape and fly around, I guess. You can't compete. So, I don't know. I kind of had some problems with some of that testing.
Yeah, I can see that. So, back to the Smith and Carlos protest. We talked about that a little bit earlier, but
right.
Did you witness that? Were you there in the stadium when that happened?
I sure was. And it came as a surprise to me. I'm sitting to think, what are those guys doing, you know? And bowed their head and held a black shoe up above their head and so forth. And I didn't even know at the time. I just figured, well, I guess I could figure it out, that they were protesting how the blacks were being treated here in America. But I don't want to seem, I don't want to come across as a prejudiced person or bigot or anything like that, because really and truly I'm not. I've known some very, very fine black people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was in poor taste. And I just would rather keep political statements out of the Olympic Games, but that's my own personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that opinion. When you got your medal and you stood up on the medal stand, what was running through your mind and what were you feeling?
Doggone, I should have won. like I say, the events leading up to and the wrist and the whole business and the fact. Now, I would have been more satisfied if Randy would have ripped one out there past 70 feet, which at that time I was unable to do. I could not throw 70 feet at that time. But in practice, I had been throwing 69.5, and all of a sudden he wins a gold medal at 67.4, I think it was, something in that range. So in other words, it was 2 feet less than I had been throwing in practice, but that hand and the taping issue and so forth. And so I was disappointed. Matter of fact, if you see, I've got a book here of Olympic, you know, for the 68 games, and showing a picture of the three medal winners sitting up there. And boy, I had such a sour look on my face. I just did not look happy at all. But, you know, I look at it differently now. I'm older. It's water under the bridge. I did get 2 silver medals out of my Olympic career. And so what the heck? You know, I had the opportunity. I didn't quite come away with it. But, you know, everything's cool with me.
So non-Olympians like me, I always assume that the biggest competition is from other nations. But it sounds like your biggest competition was within your own team.
Oh, yes, definitely. We were head and shoulders above everybody else. And that held through, 72, okay. 72, it was my turn, and I was on top at the time, throwing farther than anybody else in the world. And I don't want to get into this. It was a mess. But anyway, I got silver. I missed it by 1 centimeter. I would miss the gold. At 69, I had a 5.5, and Komar Poland had 69.6. That's American measurement. Actually, it was just 1 centimeter less, which is about 3/8 of an inch distance. But that marked the first Olympics that America had lost the gold medal in, oh, gosh, I don't know when. I don't know. We'd always been good at shot putting. We always had the top shot putters. And so if you qualified for an Olympic team in the shot put, and the discus for that matter, but in the shot put in particular, then you were automatically put into a position that you stood a chance, anyway, of winning a medal, not a gold medal necessarily, but a medal in the Olympic Games. We were that good. As a matter of fact, they used to have maybe they still have it. It's called the Pan Am Games. And they would hold that in between Olympic Games. Like, say, Olympic Games were, say, 64. Then 2 years later, they'd have the Pan Am Games, which was just strictly the Americans and, you know, everybody in this hemisphere. And then another 2 years, another Olympics. So the Olympics were every 4 years, Pan Am Games in between. And the Pan Am Games, there was only one country in the entire South America, all the way up through North America, there was only one country that even could come close to us in the shot put, and that was Canada. And Canada never had any shot putters. Hardly, you know. So I could qualify for that silly thing every year, but I never went because, yeah, I considered it not worth it. Mm. No big deal to be a Pan Am champion.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was definitely, we were definitely supreme in the shot put for a while.
Yeah. So what did you do right after your event, right after you won the silver medal in 68? What did you do?
Cried.
And after that, what did you do?
Dried my tears. No, I just, I went, I stayed the rest of the games and sat in the audience, you know, up in the stands and watched the rest of the game. Let me, I think one of the greatest inspirations, every time I think of about it today, I just get, you know, chills up and down my spine. Lee, what was his name? Lee. I can't. The 400 meter.
Lee Evans?
Champion. That's it. Lee Evans. He had a lot of pressure on him because Tommy Smith and John Carlos wanted him also to do that when he won, if he won, you know, to put the black thing. But he decided not to do it. Anyway, the point being, he had so much pressure on him and everything, and all. And the 400 meter at that time, normally on a track, it's once around the track. But they had a long straightaway to start it, going all the way down, around, and ending on the straightaway on the other side. That'd be 400 meters. I can remember sitting, I was at the open end of that track, the U, you know, and I was looking down on that last, you know, when, in other words, when he came around that turn and came toward the finish, I was looking at him right smack in the face. And he ran down, the event started, he was running round the curve, and he was not even, he was behind at that point. And all of a sudden you could look in his face and you saw inspiration. Excuse me, I can already talk about it now. I mean to tell you, he wanted to win that so bad, he gritted his teeth, started wagging his head back and forth, and you knew that he was going to win, and he did.
Remarkable.
So that was one of the most inspirational things I've ever seen. Mm. He gutted that gold medal out. That's great.
Yeah, that's wonderful that you got to be an eyewitness to that moment.
Oh, yeah, that was fabulous.
Are there any...
I was talking another story. You know, we talked earlier about Bob... I think Bob Beamon, is that it?
Yeah,
Bob Beamon?
Yes.
In the broad jump, yeah. 69.2, and that was outrageously good. But you talk about maybe the lightness of the air and so forth. I was talking to Ralph Boston after that, and Ralph said that he fouled just by a half inch. His toe just barely got over the board. And he fouled on a 28 footer, which would have been the second farthest, so it exceeded the world record at that time. And then I can't think of the guy who got third, but Davis? No, I can't remember. But he did a really, really fine job, high or low 28. So in other words, our broad jumpers just went absolutely crazy there.
Mm-hmm.
And I attribute that a lot to that light air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really helps the jumps.
Yeah, certainly. That makes sense. I've heard that theory before as well.
Mm-hmm.
So were you there for the closing ceremony?
I'm trying to think. I don't remember the closing day. So I'm wondering if we might have just, they started sending people home that wanted to go early, and I may have just gone ahead and came on home toward the middle of the last week there. So I didn't participate in either one of them after that, that game.
What was your homecoming and your reception like when you got back home?
Oh, yeah, we had a bunch of friends and my wife and meeting me at the airport. And it was neat.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked
a big party.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time. so we talked a little bit about your athletic career after 68 and the subsequent Olympic Games that you were a part of. How and when did you finally decide to retire from elite competition?
Well, I think 72 was a disappointment once again, the 1 centimeter. I decided at that point to hang on for another 4 years, but I'll tell you what, I was 36 during that, and for a shot putter, that's starting to get a little long in the tooth. And I had a disappointing year there. I hadn't thrown up to what I had in the years past. I did have a 71 foot, 2-3 inch throw or something outdoors, which is my best outdoor performance. But, I just for some reason, didn't have the spark anymore. And then, after that, everybody, all the friends I had in shot putting and so forth were quitting, and I didn't have anybody but the younger kids coming up, and I didn't want to compete with those guys. It's just, you know, so I just quit. I just decided, well, that's it. I don't want any more of it. I tried to come back. I retired after 76. I thought, well, I might come back one more year, but I'd retired for 2 years and then decided, okay, I'm going to give it a try in 1980. So I started weightlifting hard again and everything and practicing. But now there's two elements a shot putter has to do. He's got to, first of all, have his strength level as high as possible, and he's got to have the timing in his technique. And although I got my strength back by 1980, I was about 1 year away from getting that timing back. And so I wasn't throwing up to snuff. I didn't qualify for the games at that point. However, that was the games that Jimmy Carter pulled out from Olympic, you know, the team out, and because of things that Russia was doing. And so that team didn't even get to compete in the Olympics.
Mm.
And after that, I said, hey, this is just not worth the effort. So I quit.
Mm-hmm. Was that hard for you to leave your sport that you'd spent, you know, basically most of your adult life in?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, shot putting, ever since that freshman year in high school when I picked it up because that tackle I was telling you about threw the shot, and I admired him so much, so I decided to pick up the shot and see what I could do with that. Ever since that point, all the way up through 76, and even if you want to count 80, but that wasn't much of a year, but the shot put was part of my life. I considered myself as a shot putter, you know, and yeah, it's like something leaves. But on the other hand, in the back of my mind, I had to say, well, you know, you got to quit someday and sometime. And I've had a very long, good career. I've won a lot of championships, gone to a lot of things, set a world record, and all kinds of stuff like that. And I said, well, that's it.
George, can you tell me about your experiences with amateurism as it was during the 60s? And can you make a comparison of what amateurism is today versus what it was when you were an Olympian?
Well, we back in those days, we really worked under the amateur code set forth by the Olympic Committee, and we could not accept anything. We could accept, for example, in competition and so forth, a little bit for transportation to and from a track meet, for example, and we could a little bit if we're on a tour or something, a little bit to each day for meals, and that was it. If we went past that, we were in trouble, and if the Olympic Committee found out about it, they would disqualify us from Olympic competition. Today, it's just a complete opposite. They allow professional athletes to compete. Back in the day when I was competing, we all, you know, a lot of that stuff. For example, now I was fortunate that, and a lot of other track athletes, that we get scholarships to go to college and so forth, and that helped considerably. You know, at least it gave us a place to roof over our head and some meals, and we would travel with the team and so forth. But once you graduate from college, for example, it was kind of tough. Now I had to work 8 hours a day to support my wife and family, so I would have done that anyway. But like now, these guys, these professional basketball players and hockey players, I don't know. I look at it with mixed feelings, frankly, because I frankly do not agree with a person that's making $10 to $15 million a year going into the Olympic Games in his sport. Now, in his sport. I don't mind professional athletes going into the Olympics in sports that they're not making money from, you know, like the $1 million, like a basketball player could go as an ice hockey player or so whatever. And that would add a little more interest to it, I think. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I just don't think that it's fair to the world. What would happen to the amateur athlete in this case? He's shut out. There's no forum for him to participate in the Olympics anymore, especially in basketball and especially in ice hockey and whatever other sports have professional sports involvement. So I feel sorry for the amateurism. It's just gone. Now, there are sports in the Olympic Games where there's no professional sport involved, and those guys are still amateur. But I have to scratch my head and say, is that really what we wanted to do? Because it's basically amateurism is dead, I'm afraid. And I'll use this as an example. Many, many years ago when we were competing and so forth, I'll pick on the weightlifters, for example. Weightlifting, they don't have a professional sport to go to or anything like that. So the AAU, which was here in America, the amateur, the Athletic Amateur Union, held their weightlifting championships. What did they do? They held it on the West Coast. Okay, we had several good world record holders and everything else from the East Coast. So what those guys had to do, first of all, they had to support themselves. They had to buy all their food. They had to buy, you know, whatever equipment they used, pay gymnasium fees and all kinds of stuff, all on their own. They had to basically work for a living. All right, these guys, and I knew six of those guys decided they went together, they jumped in one car and drove clear across the country to compete in that championship. And then the minute it was over, they jumped in the car and drove all the way back just to keep their jobs and everything else. And I just don't think that's right. I think the amateur athlete union could have fudged a little bit. Well, not fudged. They could have changed the rules and supported. And I don't mean pay them large amounts of money, but just enough to help them in their training and so forth so they could continue in a little better way. But I certainly think I would draw the line at that point. And when we started opening it up to these guys that make Magic Johnson and some of those guys, they're a great athlete. I'm not saying anything about their abilities, but they're earning $15 million+ a year. Why would they be in an amateur setting like the Olympics? I hated to see pure amateurism go down the drain. Mm-hmm.
thank you. That was a great answer. So the next question I want to ask about the impact of being an Olympian on your personal life. What has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life?
Well, I think basically for me personally, it was, I guess, an achievement, a personal achievement, personal goal achievement and so forth. Now, when I started out in high school, we were a football town anyway, and football was king, and I loved football, loved to play football. But for some reason, in the spring, our coaches wanted us to go out for spring sports so that we could stay, you know, in some kind of conditioning for football in the fall. And I chose track. I think I may have related this to you earlier, but anyway, there was this tackle that I admired quite a bit on the football team, and he was our shot put and discus record holder. And strength always appealed to me, so I went down and started throwing that silly thing around and got hooked on shot put as well as discus, but shot put primarily. And I just started throwing it, and by the end of my senior year, I'd set the state record. I was the only Missouri or Sykeston person at that time, I don't know about recently, but to have ever won a state championship. No, I didn't only win, I set the state record and all kinds of stuff in the shot put. And that kind of got me going. I had scholarships to go on to pursue the shot put career in college, and went there. And finally, I got the idea that, boy, it'd be neat to go to the Olympics. You know, in other words, my ambitions started to escalate. And so then finally, when I finally did make the Olympic team, and made three of those Olympic Games, including the 68 was my first one. And that was the exciting one because it was the first. And so therefore, I think it was a means to an end for me. I achieved things that the goals that I had set for myself. And when I set the world record in 1974, that was more or less the culmination of the whole career, with one exception. And I know you're on 1968 here. I'll throw this in. In 2007, I was voted into the United States Track and Field Hall of Fame, and that was the crowning achievement. So, in other words, all of this career, I've gotten to meet a lot of people. I've made some good friends. I've traveled. I've been invited to hundreds of banquets and so forth to tell people about the Olympics. I like to tell a joke. One of my medals has a felt in a little box with a felt padding in it, and it's white. And that felt padding got so messed up with chicken grease, because when you go to these banquets, chicken is the main thing that they serve. And everybody with greasy hands was touching those medals when I'd pass it around. So all of that got all greasy and everything. it's been just basically a full, it's been enjoyable. It's been fun. I still, even today, as a matter of fact, I've got in my office desk drawer here a request for my autographs from a place. So periodically I'm not forgotten yet, but... So my name is out, and people, autograph seekers and so forth, still remember George Woods. But for me, primarily, it was an achievement of my goals that I had set for myself.
What do you think about the team reassembly efforts? The team getting back together at these reunion dinners and team members talking to one another. What do you think about those efforts for the team to stay together and to reunite periodically?
Oh, I think that's great. I think that's an excellent opportunity to see old friends again that you haven't seen for a while. I think it's disturbing in a way because the numbers get less and less every time we meet, because we're not spring chickens anymore. We're up in our 70s, or even, I don't know how old. Some of the guys were even older than I, but I'm 71 right now. And so those days are not promised to us anyway. And I think any time that a team like that can get together, I think that's very good, very good thing. I would like to see it more centrally located, say in the center of America, instead of, we went down in 60 or 2008, my wife and I, 1998, I think, yes, it was, went down to New Orleans, to that one, mm-hmm. And got to see a lot of people we hadn't seen before, but a lot of them are passed on now, and that's a sad thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm definitely for that activity.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Well, I'll tell you what. I guess maybe this might be, when I was competing and started college, and I'll give you some measurements. I was in my freshman year, I threw the 16-pound shots 56 feet. The next year, I was up throwing the old 58, 59 feet. And I was climbing, doing pretty well. And all of a sudden, as a sophomore, I went down to the Texas to the USTAF championships. And a young kid, right, still in high school, just graduated from high school, called Randy Mathen, threw 60 feet for the first time in his career and beat me in that meet. And that just frustrated the daylights out of me. Here I was a sophomore in college, and he was a freshman coming right out of high school. Not a freshman, well, a freshman in college, but a senior coming right out of high school, beat me. And, of course, Randy Mathen, the name, he went on to go to the 56 Olympics. Got second, I think. Let's see, is that right? 68? No, that's 64 Olympics. That's what he went to.
Mm-hmm.
He got second, and then, of course, he beat me in the games in Mexico City and was the first human ever to throw over 70 feet in the shot put. When he passed on over 70 feet, I was still throwing 61 and 62.
Mm, wow.
I mean, the guy was a phenom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But so that tells me, okay, and then later on, okay, let me finish this thought, that in 1974, I was the first human ever to throw over 72 feet with a 16-pound shot. So there, here this guy, this phenom comes up, he beats the daylights out of me, but I kept plugging away and plugging away, and every year I got a little better, a little better, a little better, till finally I broke his record. So my main thing to a young kid, if he really enjoys shot putting, now so many kids do it just because maybe they're big off the football team and the coach puts him in as a shot putter and they don't really love the sport. But if they really love the sport, hang in there. Keep plugging away. Keep practicing. Keep getting stronger every year. Keep working the technique until the timing gets better, and it'll happen. So, in other words, stick to it. That would be my main comment to younger shot putters. And that would extend to other sports. I mean, not, you know, the sprinters and anything, not just the throwers, but high jumpers, whatever the sport is, stick with it, and you'll get better.
Mm-hmm. So stick-to-itiveness or perseverance and persistence.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Good words.
I don't know. I like stick-to-itiveness.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one. Well, you gotta have that. Otherwise, you know, early on, you're gonna have your defeats. You're gonna have your moments of pain, you know, so to speak, because you're not winning as much as you think. But as you get, I noticed it in my career. The older I got, every year I'd win more meets, and the next year I'd win even more meets, and higher meets, you know, and like the NCAA championships and stuff like that. You get closer and closer each year. So mm-hmm. Keep at it.
Very good advice, George. Well, that wraps up my last question. Was there anything else that you wanted to get on the record today?
No, I think that's just about all that I can think of. I hope it was a good interview. I hope it's, you know, satisfactory.
Absolutely. Much more than satisfactory. And thank you so much. Great. For being very generous with your time and your memories.
No problem.